good morning to our friends in Taiwan and elsewhere in Asia, and good evening to our colleagues on the East Coast. I'm Larry Diamond, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and chair of the Hoover Project on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this inaugural conference of our project, which builds on the previous projects on democracy and security in Taiwan, based at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. This conference and our related research come at a time of significant change in the Indo-Pacific region. The People's Republic of China is becoming notably more authoritarian at the same time that it is more and more confidently and aggressively deploying power, hard power, sharp power, and soft power in the region and beyond. This poses growing challenges for freedom, democracy, and security in Taiwan and throughout the Indo-Pacific. Increasingly, Taiwan is recognized as one of the most liberal and vibrant democracies in Asia, and one of the great political success stories of the so-called third wave of global democratization. Yet with China reneging on its commitment to one country, two systems, gradually strangling freedom in Hong Kong, and evincing a more belligerent posture toward Taiwan, many believe we're entering a new, more volatile and dangerous period. We have an excellent roster of speakers lined up for these next 3 weeks to explore these and other issues connected to Taiwan's place in a free and open Indo-Pacific. I want to begin by acknowledging the great work of our project manager and research fellow, Dr. Glenn Tiffert, and the tireless efforts of the senior manager for Hoover events, Betsy Phillips, and her team, especially Janet Smith, and the administrative support of Amy Alonso, all at the Hoover Institution. I also want to thank the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office in San Francisco for its generous support of this project. Now I'd like to hand it over to Admiral James Ellis, Annenberg Distinguished Fellow at the Hoover Institution, who will moderate today's session. Admiral Ellis led the U.S. Strategic Command and commanded the U.S. Independence Carrier Battle Group during the Third Taiwan Strait Crisis in 1996. And he is the former president and CEO of the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations. Admiral Ellis.
Thank you, Larry. And again, congratulations to you and your team for convening this this important series of meetings and conference over these next few weeks that is particularly timely and, as you said, relevant to the issues in play today. During his confirmation hearing last July, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper made it abundantly clear that his top priority would be implementing the 2017 U.S. National Defense Strategy, which informs us, not surprisingly, that we are now in an era of great power competition and that China, and only then Russia, constitute our top strategic competitors. At the top of his top 10 goals, the priority that drives and underlies many of our national security efforts today is to focus the Department of Defense on China. He tasked the military departments and services to make China the pacing threat, his emphasis added, in all DoD schools, programs, and training. Recently, Elbridge Colby and Jim Miter have argued that of all potential confrontations with China, a conflict over Taiwan is the key scenario for many reasons that certainly all of you understand. They believe that the U.S. defense establishment and those of our regional partners should focus on preparing their militaries for a potential Taiwan scenario above all others, because of its pivotal character and because all other regional challenges with China are lesser included cases. Adapting the U.S. military to be able to defend Taiwan will be hard, but it is necessary, they believe, in order to also enable the United States to deter China and, if necessary, help defend other allies in Asia against the People's Republic of China. As noted in the oft-quoted 2015 RAND Corporation study, Chinese military capabilities have improved dramatically relative to those of the United States over the nearly 2.5 decades since the so-called third Taiwan Strait crisis, which Larry has always referenced. As you recall, we responded with two U.S. carrier battle groups. Incidentally, the mainland Chinese, perhaps giving us more credit than we are due, are reported to still believe that the initially responding carrier group, an element of the 7th Fleet, was dispatched primarily because of the name of my flagship, USS Independence. If only we were so clever. Nevertheless, the PLA entered the 1990s so far behind the US military in so many areas that Chinese modernization had few immediate consequences. It was not until the mid-2000s that the cumulative weight of PLA modernization began to coalesce into a significant challenge to US regional primacy. But even that seminal RAND study of 5 years ago did not systematically integrate the potential contributions of partners and allies in both deterrence and conflict. The authors of that study recommended that the contribution or impact of green or third country forces should also be systematically evaluated. For example, in a Taiwan invasion scenario, partners and allies would be essential. If local forces could resist effectively and buy some time for the United States to marshal its forces, U.S. intervention would be more effective and less costly than if U.S. forces had to act more hastily to stave off disaster. Military elements from other third countries, such as Japan, might be able to assist with important tasks, such as submarine or especially anti-submarine warfare, even if a conflict did not initially directly threaten its own territory. With Chinese military capabilities continuing to mature, meeting this challenge will require a new focus by the United States. Unless and until the United States adjusts its regional commitments, maintaining the capability to meet those commitments will require the ongoing review of procurement priorities, concepts of operations, basing posture, and importantly for today's panel, political military relationships with regional partners, as well as engagement with Beijing, to reduce the likelihood that China and the United States will ever turn weapons on one another. It's now my pleasure to briefly introduce our discussants and our panelists today. The first discussant is Dr. Joseph Felter. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution and former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for South Asia, Southeast Asia, and Oceania. And he co-directs the Empirical Studies of Conflict Project at Stanford Center for International Security and Cooperation. A former Army Special Forces and Foreign Area Officer, Joe has a great deal of operational as well as policy expertise. Next is Dr. Chae-Chuan Lee. He's the Chief of the National Security and Decision-Making Division at the Institute for National Defense and Security Research in Taiwan. Formerly, he served on Taiwan's Mainland Affairs Council, its National Security Council, and in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And he too brings a wealth of experience to our conversation. The first of our three panelists will be Dr. Philip Sanders, who is the director for the Center of Study of Chinese Military Affairs and a distinguished research fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at National Defense University. He is co-author of The Paradox of Power, Sino-American Strategic Restraint in an Era of Vulnerability. Dr. Sanders' paper, The Changing Balance of Military Power in the Indo-Pacific Region, assesses changes in the regional military balance, discusses Chinese military options with respect to Taiwan, including gray zone military actions below the threshold of lethal force. He then considers China's ability to translate its improved military capabilities into desired political outcomes at an acceptable cost. Our second panelist is Mr. Tetsuo Katani, a senior fellow at the Japan Institute of International Affairs and a professor at Mikai University. He was a visiting scholar and the Japan chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. His research focuses on the U.S.-Japan alliance and maritime security. Mr. Katani's paper reviews Indo-Pacific strategies of Quad members, Japan, the United States, Australia, and India, regional partners, ASEAN, South Korea, and Taiwan, and European partners, France, Britain, and Germany, to identify respective interests, priorities, and challenges, as well as their views on China. I thank all of our panelists and discussants for joining us here today. And without any further ado, I'd like to give the floor to Dr. Philip Sanders. Phil?
Great, thanks. I've started the video. And since Admiral Ellis gave an overview of what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to skip that part of my presentation and try to buy back some time for substance. I want to start by talking a little bit about the regional military balance. And I think my assessment, we have a book on great power competition that should be released later this month, is that the US military still has significant quantitative and qualitative advantages over the PLA, especially in a long conflict that gives the US time to bring all of its assets to bear. And if you walk through that, you look at PAC fleet, which has about 50 major surface combatants, two or three aircraft carriers, approximately 30 advanced US nuclear submarines, controls three numbered US forces with some 2,000 fighters, has about 80,000 forward deployed ground troops, and another 100,000 deployable from the continental US as required. But more importantly, the US military has advantages in its proven ability to employ space-based intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, and cyber capabilities to support its ground, air, and naval forces operating as a joint force. And so there's synergies there that the US has proven in its operations. It's absolutely true that the PLA has gained a lot of ground over the last 20 to 25 years. They operate three fleets with more than 130 surface combatants, but they don't really have a long-range blue water warfare capability. Their aircraft carriers are decades behind the US design. Its bombers are based on a 1950s Soviet design, although they do have new engines and very capable land attack and anti-ship missiles. PLA's been organized for fighting limited conflicts along its borders, but over the last 15 years, it started to emphasize efforts to improve its power projection capability, including its air, naval, and missile forces, and to develop the ability to conduct joint operations. They've recently undergone a major organizational reform that changes how the parts of the PLA work with each other and greatly improves their ability to conduct joint operations. So this competition between the US and China in the Indo-Pacific certainly has a conventional military aspect, which is the types of military capabilities that I've been talking about. But China has a geographic advantage when it's operating from its own home territory, especially if the conflict is close to Chinese territory, where they can use ground-based missiles and aircraft to project power out over water and into the nearby space. And conversely, the US has to fight an away game. We have to deploy assets forward into China's access denial capabilities and fight close to them. And so that's a significant advantage for the PLA. So I wanna, having talked about this broadly in the region, I wanna turn to the cross-strait balance. And if I can have the first slide, I'm gonna walk through some comparisons with the PRC and Taiwan's military. Okay, so this looks at the PLA forces that are deployed in the Eastern and Southern theaters, and it compares them to Taiwan's military forces. And what you see there is a huge quantitative advantage for the PLA. Even if we're just looking at the parts that are closest to Taiwan, you see that in forces, you see it in tanks and artillery, you see it in the Navy, you see it in fighter aircraft, bomber aircraft, transport aircraft. And the first numbers are those that are in those theaters. But for the aircraft in particular, they have the ability to keep reinforcing from outside from other theater commands and move those forces forward. So what's here pretty quickly is that there's a significant quantitative advantage. The other thing that's changed over the last 20 years is Taiwan used to have a qualitative advantage by using advanced Western aircraft and Navy and missiles and missile defenses. The PLA has made up a lot of that qualitative ground. So now I think it's fair to say it's at least on a par in qualitative terms and has a significant quantitative advantage. But just looking at the raw numbers doesn't necessarily tell you how the PLA would try to use that force and what it might look like. So let me go to the next slide, and I'm going to walk through a couple of the conventional military options that the PRC has. So one of those options is to try to do a blockade, to cut off all air and maritime traffic to Taiwan. If the PLA were to try this, it would be a combined effects blockade. They would use both kinetic, air, naval, and missile actions, but likely also include electronic warfare, cyber, and information operations as part of these blockade efforts. And it's not just interdicting ships that are coming there, likely would involve attacks on port and air facilities to really try to isolate Taiwan. So that would involve also deploying PLA air and maritime forces, not just around Taiwan, but probably further out into the South China Sea, East China Sea, and Philippine Sea. Might involve seizure of Taiwan's outlying islands, and it would leverage those anti-access area denial capabilities that I mentioned to both support and defend its blockade activities. So if you think about this as an option, it's short of a full-scale invasion, so the costs and risks are not as high. It's certainly a resolute act to coerce Taiwan, but it's somewhere short of invasion. But if you think about it from a political point of view, it takes time for an air and naval blockade to be set up and really to begin to bite. That's weeks and probably months. There's a significant international backlash and reaction, and that time gives outsized powers the time to mobilize forces and get there. And moreover, it's unlikely necessarily to result in Taiwan capitulating, in particular if outside powers intervene. So this is an option, certainly for PRC leaders, but not necessarily a decisive one in achieving the political end state of unification. Let's go to the next slide. So another option the PLA talks about in its literature is air and missile strikes, what they call a joint fire strike campaign. This is basically the use of strikes to try to inflict enough damage to compel Taiwan to accept PRC terms. A first strike would employ precision strikes targeting Taiwan's air and missile defenses to try to achieve air superiority. Then this would be followed with attacks by air force and missile forces with less precision, but the durability to keep striking. And that would target military and infrastructure targets and try to put pressure on Taiwan and also degrade Taiwan's various military defensive capabilities. So the pros of this is the PRC has the advantage and probably can execute this campaign pretty well. It can maintain that second stage indefinitely with conventional assets that are less precise. Cons, Taiwan has some offensive missiles that it can use to retaliate. But I think the big con is that this is unlikely to result in capitulation or surrender. The previous historical examples of trying to use airstrikes, air bombing, to achieve decisive results show that typically the public rallies to the government and is able to endure considerable punishment. And also you have the issue of international reaction and backlash. If this is not a decisive campaign, international pressure is going to mount. And again, you have time for the U.S. to deploy more forces to the theater. Let's go to the next slide, please. The other big option is invasion. And that would be an amphibious invasion across the strait that would likely build upon one or both of these prior campaigns that I've just talked about. How it would look like in phasing, again, attacks on Taiwan's air and missile defense, long-range artillery strikes against the beach, airstrikes, and anti-ship cruise missile and submarine attacks to try to take out Taiwan's Navy. That would be followed by an amphibious assault to establish a beachhead, and airborne and air assault to try to seize airfields and ports that would allow the PLA to use civilian transportation assets to provide air and sea lift. Right now, it doesn't look like the PLA has enough organic military sea lift and airlift to really carry out everything they need to do. And then finally, the PLA would have to land sufficient ground combat forces, both to defeat Taiwan's ground forces and then provide ammunition and other supplies to support them during combat operations. So the pros of this is a decisive action. If the PLA can execute this successfully, they would physically seize Taiwan and be able to impose unification. And PLA has the advantages of military assets and resources that I talked about in the first slide. If you have enough time, can keep trying this, eventually you will probably wear out the Taiwan military and may achieve victory. You know, that said, an amphibious landing is about the most complicated military operation there is. The Taiwan military is pretty well advanced, equipped, and trained. I have looked at the overall defense concept that you'll hear more about. That seems like a clever way of focusing on the things, asymmetric advantages Taiwan would have, to really complicate the PLA's ability to carry off an invasion. There's the potential for U.S. intervention. And even if the PLA succeeds, it's unclear whether unification would be accepted by the Taiwan public, or is that the start of a lengthy insurgency operation that causes more problems for the PLA? So at the end of the day, this is a very costly and pretty risky option to try to pull off. Okay, let me go to, let's leave that slide up there. I want to talk a little bit about that. What you see with all three of these is they have considerable costs and risks in trying to execute these as military operations. But at the end of the day, the PLA does have significant military advantages over Taiwan. Given enough time, it can grind Taiwan down. So then the question is, well, what if the United States decides to intervene? That is something the PLA has expected since the 1995-96 crisis. They've invested in an array of anti-access area denial capabilities designed to raise the costs and risk of U.S. forces operating near China, with the goal of deterring or defeating U.S. intervention. That's advanced diesel submarines, that's advanced surface-to-air missiles, it's anti-ship cruise missiles and anti-ship ballistic missiles designed to target U.S. carriers. That's anti-satellite weapons, it's advanced cyber offensive capabilities. And all of this raises the costs and risks for U.S. forces intervening. Admiral Ellis mentioned the RAND study, which tracked, did a net assessment of PRC and U.S. capabilities and found that U.S. advantages were eroding in many of these areas. I think the new development that the RAND study didn't capture is Department of Defense is increasingly focused on how to adapt U.S. weapons and operating concepts to fight the U.S. in this anti-access area denial construct. There's not time to go through all of this, but Indo-Pacific Commander Admiral Davidson has developed a six-year, $20 billion investment program for the U.S. to regain the advantage over China. We see all the services investing in new concepts and capabilities designed to operate in this environment, whether that's the U.S. Navy figuring out how to break the kill chain required for Chinese anti-ship ballistic missiles, or whether it's the U.S. ability to operate from expeditionary, austere locations, whether it's the U.S. Army's multi-domain task forces, or the Marine Corps' shift in its force modernization efforts.
2 minutes, Bill, please.
Okay, I was going to talk a little bit about the gray zone. I think the point is, let's go to the next slide and I will wrap up on that slide. The point here is that all of these military operations are risky. That's pushed the PLA in the direction of using lower level non-lethal means that we talk about in the gray zone. You see some of those on this slide. The advantage is it's incremental and tailorable pressure. The real con there is it's hard to translate that pressure into the objective of unification. And just to wrap up with that, the PLA has gained a lot of ground against the US military. It's gained even more ground against the Taiwan military. But the challenge is to convert that into the political outcome that it wants, unification. The costs of risks of trying to execute these military options are high. A Chinese leader who tried and failed would be putting his personal political survival at risk. So I think at the end of the day, the U.S. is trying to do more to regain the advantage. Taiwan has some of the right things to do, but in my view is not spending enough money to fully execute those capabilities. If we do more in U.S. military modernization and concepts, and Taiwan does more in executing the overall defense concept and especially funding it, I think that will help maintain peace in the Taiwan Strait and in the Indo-Pacific more broadly. And let me stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Great summary and a great beginning for the panel. I'm now pleased to turn the microphone and the presentation over to Mr. Tetsuo Kotani his perspective on not just regional allies, but global allies, all of whom would have an interest in the region and in a potential Taiwan conflict. Mr. Kotani.
Thank you, Admiral Ellis, and thanks for the FUBA Institution for inviting me. So the topic given to me is the Indo-Pacific strategies of key U.S. allies and partners. So let me first briefly review Indo-Pacific strategies of Quad countries, meaning Japan, U.S., Australia, and India, and regional countries such as ASEAN, South Korea, and Taiwan, and followed by extra-regional European partners, UK, France, and Germany. Then I will summarize what they have in common, what are the differences in interests and priorities, and particularly how they see China differently. So first, Quad countries. The concept of Quad has its origin in the quadrilateral response to the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. And as all of the four countries became concerned about the growing China's aggression and also China's growing influence under the BRI, the Quad nations resumed strategic dialogue in 2017. And they discussed they started to discuss the rules-based order, quality infrastructure, maritime security, and non-proliferation. And in addition to the HADR, the scope of the Quad is expanding, and it is now discussing the rulemaking in digital economy and the global health, including the response to the COVID-19. Among the Quad countries, the United States is pursuing great power competition with China, and the U.S. expects the other Quad countries to follow its competitive approach without engagement, including the decoupling of global supply chain. However, Japan, Australia, and India, they are still taking both competitive approach and engagement with China. So there are slight difference among the four countries. And recently, the U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, called for further institutionalization of Quad to counter the rise of China. But the other three countries are still cautious to join the U.S. containment of China. On the other hand, U.S. has not fully reassured its allies and partners in the region as it seeks further financial contribution from its allies. And also the U.S. is facing a problem of resource allocation from the Middle East to the Indo-Pacific in pursuit of the 2018 National Defense Strategy. The four countries also have different perception on regional economic integration. The U.S. has withdrawn from the TPP, and India is withdrawing from the RCEP negotiation, while Japan and Australia, they see the multilateral economic integration as critical policy for their economic policy. Now let's look at the other regional partners. First, ASEAN. For ASEAN, the Indo-Pacific concept is a sensitive one. ASEAN relies on the United States for security, particularly to preserve stability in the South China Sea, while it is an active participant in the BRI. Also, the emphasis on the Indo-Pacific might undermine the unity and centrality of ASEAN. The ASEAN Indo-Pacific Outlook of 2019 emphasizes ASEAN centrality, openness, transparency, inclusiveness, rules-based approach, mutual trust, respect, and interest. It rejects to join in encirclement of China and focuses on economy rather than security. So it seems to be more aligned with China's BRI rather than the US Indo-Pacific strategy. Of course, some ASEAN member countries are more willing to work with Quad, and some are more reluctant. But because of the importance of ASEAN unity, I don't think ASEAN will be aligned with Quad positively. So in some sense, ASEAN attempts to avoid taking sides between US and China and struggle to find the right place in the great power competition. South Korea has been promoting the new Southern policy since 2017. The South Koreans refuse to use the term Indo-Pacific, but this new Southern policy aims to strengthen a strategic and comprehensive relationship with ASEAN and India. South Korea's relationship with ASEAN has been more economy focused, but under this new policy, the South Korea is now attempting to widen the area of cooperation, including political and security. South Korea faces difficult relationship with the United States, China, Japan, and North Korea. So in some sense, the new South Korea's new policy is a attempt to find a new diplomatic outlet in ASEAN and India. And Taiwan also launched the new southbound policy in 2016. It aims to expand Taiwan's relationship with ASEAN, South Asia, Australia, and New Zealand through economic, trade cooperation, people's exchange, resources sharing, and regional partnerships. Taiwan is not necessarily seeking to enhance strategic security cooperation with regional countries. It is rather trying to tighten economic and cultural relationship with those partners. But Taiwan is also attempting to reduce its economic reliance on China while keeping its diplomatic maneuverability open. In this sense, Taiwan's new policy is more aligned with the Quad's Indo-Pacific strategies. Now let's turn to Europe. Among the European nations, the Britain has not released its official Indo-Pacific strategy yet, but in the context of Brexit and the global Britain, it is now returning to the east of Suez through the five power defense arrangement. And UK clearly recognizes the growing importance of the region for its economic policy. And after 2018, Britain stepped up its security engagement in the region through the combined exercises and training with Japan and the United States. And also the UK is trying to increase the presence operation in the South China Sea. And the recent conclusion of Japan-UK economic partnerships and the possible UK's participation in the TPP-11 would make the Indo-Pacific more important for Britain. Britain's view on China are becoming realistic, but it remains to be seen how much the China factor affects the Britain's concept of the Indo-Pacific. Then France recognized itself as a Indo-Pacific power, given its territory and economic zone in the Pacific. France's recent Indo-Pacific strategy emphasizes the region's growing economic importance, as well as the risks such as North Korean nuclear development and the militarization of the South China Sea, terrorism, and climate change. France maintains military presence in the South Pacific, where it conducts patrol with Australia and New Zealand. France is also strengthening security ties with Japan and India. France deployed its aircraft carrier to the South China Sea to demonstrate its commitment to the region in 2019. It remains unclear, however, how the China factor will shape France's approach to the Indo-Pacific. And Germany is the latest European newcomer to the Indo-Pacific. Germany just recently published its policy guidance for the Indo-Pacific. Germany has a wide variety of interests in this region, such as peace and security, partnerships, freedom of choice regarding membership of economic and security architecture, freedom of navigation, free trade, digital economy, environmental conservation, and fact-based information. The new guidelines also refers to EU's engagement with Asia, the promotion of multilateralism, maintenance of the rules-based order, commitment to the UN development goals, respect for human rights, and other issues. Germany's economic dependence on China is heavy, but the shift toward the Indo-Pacific indicates that Germany is also becoming realistic in terms of the perception of challenges posed by China. But again, it is still unclear how the China factor will actually affect the Germans' approach to the region. So in conclusion, US allies and friends all share interest in the maintenance of rules-based order, freedom of navigation, and the promotion of physical and digital connectivity in the Indo-Pacific. Quad is leading the Indo-Pacific strategies, and Taiwan and the European countries are more aligned with Quad. When ASEAN and South Korea will maintain certain distance from the Quad and seek third ways or right places in the US-China great power competition. Even among the Quad members, there are some disagreement, for instance, over trade liberalization and multilateralism. More importantly, US and other three Quad members have different perception of engagement with China. I think the United States needs to implement its Indo-Pacific strategy in a way that the other countries in the region can accept, while encouraging those countries to play a greater role in upholding the rules-based order to meet the challenges posed by China. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's excellent and a great reminder that security and defense cooperation in the Indo-Pacific is of interest, critical interest, to far more nations than those that simply reside there. So thanks very much. I'd now like to move to the first of our two discussants, and that would be Dr. Joe Felter. And
great. Well, thanks, Admiral Ellis. And thanks, Larry Glenn, for organizing and hosting. It's a real privilege to be part of this great event. So I'm going to spend just a few minutes on the first of the two papers after coordinating with Glenn, the changing balance of military power in the Indo-Pacific region, and then Tetsuo Kotani's Indo-Pacific strategies and the perspective of key allies and partners. And I was going to provide some summary, but given the time, I'm going to try to just go over that very briefly. But I will provide just a quick summary beginning with the first paper, the U.S.-China Regional Military Balance. So again, I thought the authors did a great job with a clear assessment of the military balance. You know, talking Indo-PACOM assets, but also importantly, including the space and cyber assets, among others, which is really going to be obviously a key factor in any future conflicts. You had four parts. The next part go into the military balance and cross-strait relations. I think you described a few of the PLA's military options, you know, the blockade, coordinated missile, and airstrikes, and their plans for a full-fledged invasion of the island. This is really a parse that are developed well in the paper, but I think it was even better in your presentation. So you may even want to add some of your presentation comments into the paper, but great job with this section. Then you go into the U.S. factor in cross-strait security, you know, emphasizing how China has this home field advantage and that the United States were going to have to deploy forces from very far away. And you emphasize that while China's not close to catching up outright to the U.S. military, you know, as far as its capabilities, but it doesn't need parity to frustrate U.S. intervention. And I think that's a key point you emphasize in the paper. And also, I thought it was important that you emphasize how the Department of Defense is increasingly focused on adapting U.S. weapons and operating concepts to fight the PLA. I just interviewed Michelle Flournoy last week, who's, you know, won't get political, but we may be seeing more of her in the Defense Department. But she emphasized that it's not the technology and not the weapon systems, but a real emphasis on, you know, how this technology enables us to have new operational concepts and capabilities. So I think you emphasize this here. Talked about the kill chain, maybe a nod to Christian Breaux's new book, which is really presents this very well. But then into the gray zone. I think this was one of your bottom line comments you made in this section. And I'm just going to, you said that it's not straightforward for the PLA, whether it can convert its growing military power advantage into political outcomes it seeks with Taiwan. And I think that was a very, very powerful statement in this section. Moving past the conclusion, looking at commentary, I thought the most compelling point you made up front was that the regional military balance in terms of relative U.S. and Chinese capabilities is important, but the real U.S. strategic center of gravity is the political military relationships that underpin U.S. alliances and the forward deployed military presence they support. I think this is really, really critical. It's consistent with our national defense strategy, our line of effort too, really are the U.S. comparative advantage. You know, we have five treaty allies in the region. Who does China have? Maybe North Korea. And the other democracies in the region, they care. You think about the Quad countries and beyond. And this cooperation is on the rise. We had a ministerial level Quad just last week in Tokyo, and we'll cover that more in the next paper. But when you look at balance in the region, the U.S. is an important factor. But if you look at the U.S. with our partners and allies, it's a whole different calculation. So I used to teach international relations. I know as realists, you're supposed to be skeptical of the durability of alliances. But I think we really need to strive, you know, to leverage that comparative advantage to help Taiwan defend itself, you know, to support the Taiwan Relations Act, but really leverage the alliances that really provide us, I think, significant opportunities, opportunities that the CCP will never be able to compete effectively or close the gap as far as our ability to work with allies and partners. Jim, I guess I'll just move on to the next paper, and I'm looking just a few minutes, huh? So I'll have to hurry up here.
Yeah.
Second paper, Indo-Pacific Strategies, Perspectives of the Key U.S. Allies and Partners. I'm just going to go up front what I thought was a major contribution to this paper, and that's that it provides different perspectives it acknowledges that even our closest allies have different perspectives on the Indo-Pacific strategy. And I've been in defense roles, policy roles, and I'll admit, the United States doesn't always appreciate the differences in perspective among our allies and partners. We tend to kind of sometimes be a little bit tone deaf, and there's really no quicker way to alienate even our closest allies than to tell them what their interests are versus to seek to understand them. And I think that you made this point very, very well. And I think there's a really strong point in the paper. I'm going to skip the summary, but you go through, I'm just going to hit a great, great discussion of Japan's strategy. And I think there's a sense in the United States that we came up with this Indo-Pacific strategy, the free and open Indo-Pacific. But you mentioned Abe's role in the free and Indo-Pacific strategy, going back to, you know, his first stint as prime minister back in, you know, when he gave his confluence of the two C's to the parliament back in 2007. he talked about the Democratic security diamond back then, you know, which kind of looking at the Quad. So again, I think this is a great nod to the very, very significant, important role that, Japan has had strategically in, articulating this Indo-Pacific strategy for, from very early days. And I'll just make a few comments on this at the end, and I'm running over here, Jim. Let's see. So a great discussion of Australia into the Quad. And let me just go back to some comments. Again, a great discussion based on different countries' perspectives. Great reminder of Japan's leadership potential. I think to have some criticism, I think you're a little hard on the United States and how it interpret our how we interpret our national security strategy and national defense strategy. We have not given up on engagement. We intend to cooperate wherever we can with China. And I think we certainly recognize that some of these transnational issues and other issues like climate, pandemic, terrorism, we're going to have to cooperate with China. And I think the paper was a little bit dismissive of U.S. Interest in cooperating. And certainly we may see a new perspective if and when there's a new national defense strategy published, national security strategy. So, and again, importantly, the U.S., I think you imply the U.S. is asking countries to choose, and we don't. You know, we ask countries to choose their own sovereignty. You know, this is not a competition between the United States and China in the region, but it's better framed as a competition between visions. You know, the U.S., I would argue, has a shared vision that, that's embraced in the region, whereas China has to be imposed and coerced. So again, it was a great description of the many countries who have interest in the Indo-Pacific region, both in the region and beyond in Europe. One last thing, very good description. Maybe you can try to add a little bit of a predictive part of this paper. I mean, what are some of the main challenges and opportunities for Quad and other countries in the region to advance their shared interests? What is it going to look like in Japan post-Abe? But Jim, I apologize for running a bit late, and I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Joe. Great insights from a guy who's walked the walk. Dr. Chae-Kwon Lee, your comments on the papers or those that you choose to focus on, please.
Thank you, Admiral. And first of all, I'd like to express my gratitude to have the opportunity to be here today. And I have one question for Dr. Sanders. In your paper, I like it very much. You mentioned the POA have developed A2AD capabilities pretty well, and it is now using a lot of gray zone operation or activity in the area of Taiwan Strait. So my question is, what is your assessment about recent debate arising in Washington, D.C. about how the United States are supposed to deal with the POA's activity on the traditional so-called strategic ambiguity would suit better, or maybe the United States should take a so-called strategic clarity for the current situation across the Taiwan Strait? And what do you think Taiwan can do to counter or to offset the gray zone operation conducted by the POA against Taiwan? And lastly, I have one question for Professor Kotani. In your paper, you mentioned that countries like Japan, India, South Korea, and ASEAN members stressed that the importance of inclusiveness of Indo-Pacific strategy. But in late July and recently, the United States emphasized the importance to formulate a coalition from democratic countries to deter or to change the CCP regime. And I'd like to know your assessment about the two phenomena. Do you think the proposal of establishing an Asian NATO compatible to the main theme of the Indo-Pacific strategy, I mean, inclusiveness, or do you think it is possible that an anti-China coalition can coexist with the Indo-Pacific strategy? Thank you. I'll stop here.
Thank you very much. Great answer. Phil, he tossed a couple your way. One of them dealt on the strategic ambiguity piece, and the other was on gray zone operations. Would you care to comment on those?
Sure. And the gray zone piece is a hard one. because there's kind of two senses in which it's gray zone. One is it's avoiding lethal force, and the other is it's exploiting ambiguity in U.S. commitments. What I think Taiwan can do on its own is maybe be a little less predictable in how it responds to PLA gray zone operations. So if they come over the center line, you know, one way you can respond is to launch fighters and go up and take a look and intercept them. That's very predictable. And that gives the PLA the ability to dictate your response and how much you spend on doing this. This is the same problem that the Japanese Air Self-Defense Force has faced with Russian and Chinese intrusions. But one thing you could do is sometimes you track them with surface-to-air missiles, and that's your response, and you communicate with the planes and say you're being tracked by surface-to-air missiles. Sometimes you send up two fighters to intercept. Sometimes maybe you overreact and send up a lot more planes than they were expecting. So that's one thing you can do, is to be less predictable in the response. And that then becomes an element which maybe deters some of this activity. Yes, there is a debate about strategic ambiguity. I'm not one who sees the U.S. as needing to change policy on that. There's two reasons for that. The reason why the policy is what it is so that Taiwan doesn't take the U.S. for granted and either do provocative things which might lead to a conflict, or neglect its own defense. That is the so-called free rider problem. And so I think that is a downside of clarifying U.S. commitments. And then I would also say the PLA has been factoring the United States in since 1996. They received the message that the U.S. might intervene, and they've been building forces and planning to prepare for that. So I think they are very attuned to the possibility that the United States would intervene. And I'm not sure that necessarily clarifying that commitment would change that very much. I mean, to some degree, the risk of the possibility of U.S. Intervention is already a significant deterrent for the PLA.
Thanks, Phil. Mr. Khatani, Dr. Lee asked you to address the tensions between military alliances or relationships or partnerships or coalitions, acknowledging that those are not at all the same thing, and the economic reliance that exists in the region, but indeed throughout the world in the relationship with China. Do you think you can sustain both a more formal military relationship for those in the neighborhood and in the other allies globally, and can that coexist with an economic robust and economic interchange?
I think under the current situation, the Asian countries would prefer keeping informal, flexible mechanism to deal with the regional issues, including security and economic problems. And I think it's ultimately it depends on how China will behave in the future. If the aggressiveness continues, if China invades the territory of other nations, I think that will definitely lead to the establishment of a more formal military alliance among the like-minded nations, perhaps based on the Quad mechanism. But unless such a scenario comes up, I think it is still better for the Asian nations to keep the multilateral mechanism as a less formal one. Thank you.
Those are great responses to three or four very insightful questions from Dr. Lee. Joe, do you have any other specific questions you'd like to see addressed before we move into a Q&A from the participants?
Gosh, you know, maybe just like predictive, what do we see going forward? I know there's a great description by the paper, but you know, what might be the challenges and opportunities for greater Quad cooperation and regional cooperation going forward?
Mr. Khatani, would you care to talk about opportunities that you think are perhaps unrealized that might offer the potential?
Yes. I actually tried to answer that question partly in my paper. So the question is whether or not we should seek the further institutionalization of Quad to deal with the lots of security challenges. And the United States is clearly very much interested in that. But Japan, Australia, India might be still cautious. And, you know, the India is still, for some reason, reluctant to invite Australia into the Malabar naval exercise. So I think, again, I still think the Quad is a very important mechanism to discuss the regional issues. But for the actual actions, I think it still needs to come from a bilateral or trilateral approach.
Thank you, sir.
Right. Okay, moving on to questions and answers. And we've got a raft of them here, about 20 or more. And so I'm going to do what I can to combine them. But the first one will go to Phil. And looking at this from a historical perspective, how does the gap between the U.S. and the PRC forces compare to our perceptions of decades past? I mean, we all remember missile gaps, real or imagined, 10 feet tall Russian forces that perhaps weren't when we got a chance to peek behind the curtain. How do you see all this? Is there a comparison here that's worthy, or is this a different situation, Phil?
Well, sure. That's a great question by Tom Finger. If we look at it in the U.S.-Soviet context, it was a local Soviet conventional advantage that was the key threat that led the United States to lean on nuclear weapons to offset that. That started a nuclear arms race, and we wound up with mutually assured destruction, where neither side really dared to take a move for fear of starting a nuclear war. So that's one thing that's different, that in the U.S.-China competition, this seems to be mainly a conventional competition with both sides thinking they can fight conventionally and stay below the threshold of escalation to the nuclear level. So I think that's a very important thing that's different. A second thing is the Soviets were tied to the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet bloc, and that was their economic sphere. China's different. It needs energy, it needs resources, it needs markets within Asia and all over the world, so it can't stay at home. It has to be involved in the world, and that produces vulnerabilities, and that produces a demand for a larger military role. So that's something different, that was a geographically focused competition. The U.S.-China competition is going to have global elements to it. And then I think the third thing that's different is now we have a much greater role for space, counter space, cyber, and hypersonic weapons. The implications of this are unclear. We've never seen two advanced militaries going at each other with all of these systems. Seems to me there's a significant risk of escalation that's unexpected. And it also makes it harder to do a net assessment of how well all of that stuff is gonna work. Because our doctrine is to paralyze, blind the adversary's ISR and paralyze their command and control. Well, gosh, that's China's doctrine as well. And we've never seen two advanced militaries going at each other with that way. So part of the military balance deals with those things and new technologies such as artificial intelligence. And it's a lot harder to figure out what that really means, how it translates to usable capabilities, and how that would play out in a wartime context. So I think that's one other thing that's different. It's harder to do a net assessment and know really where you stand. And if I can have 30 more seconds, I have to say, I owe an apology. My paper and presentation was co-authored with Major Kevin McGinnis, late of the Air Force Academy. And I had that on my first slide and it's on the paper, but you don't have the paper and I didn't show the first slide. So I have to make sure I give Major McGinnis full credit for his hard work on this paper as well.
Thank you, Phil. Mr. Khatani, there's a question here that asks us to parse the ASEAN membership and their positions and interests a bit more finely. It specifically addresses the Philippines and Vietnam. To what extent are their interests aligned, or is the only commonality their shared confrontation with China? Can you talk a little bit more detail inside the ASEAN relationship?
So for the Philippines, I think the Philippines share the basic interest with Japan, US, and other regional countries. But at this moment, we have an unpredictable president in the Philippines. So it's a little bit difficult to understand how the Philippines will align with either China or the US and other US key allies. But fundamentally, I think the Philippines share the interest in the regional issues. So depending on who will lead the country in the coming years, I think there should be a more alignment with the Philippines. And for Vietnam, I think definitely Vietnam shares the same concern and interest with US and its key allies. But because of the different regimes, it's still a little bit sensitive to promote the security cooperation. But I think it's a question of time. And as other ASEAN member countries become more willing to work with the US and other key partners, then I think definitely we can further strengthen the ties with Vietnam.
Mario Chima references a paper that many of us have read in 2010, an opinion piece called Not So Dire Straits in Foreign Affairs, advocated for the Finlandization of Taiwan, in a sense, as a way to enhance U.S. security while maintaining de facto independence. And in this scenario, as you recall, Taiwan would pledge neutrality, non-alignment with the U.S. and others, while the PRC would pledge to respect Taiwan's de facto autonomy. So is that a realistic prospect in this day and age, or are we beyond that, given the provocations and the disparity that Phil Saunders talked about in military strength? And that's probably intended for all, but we'll start with Phil. Phil, your comments?
I don't think it's viable anymore, because Russia didn't care so much about Finland as Finland. It cared about it strategically. But for the PRC, Taiwan status is an unfinished legacy of the Civil War, and it's part of their broader project of undoing the century of so-called century of humiliation. So leaving it as it is, the PRC leaders have decided is not a permanent option.
Okay.
That said, there's another question. Well, does that mean there's a deadline or a timeline? They have talked about this as something to be done by 2049, but I think in practice, the PRC policy can either emphasize deterring independence, which is easy because Taiwan has no plans to formally declare independence, or achieving unification, which is a lot harder because you have to fundamentally change the status quo. But the ability to pivot between those two things gives Beijing a lot of flexibility not to box itself into a position where it has to do something it doesn't want to do.
Thank you.
But I think Finlandization is no longer a viable option for Beijing.
Mr. Tani, your perception on that fairly controversial and albeit dated opinion?
You know, the security of Taiwan is critical to the security of Japan. And, you know, there was some question from the audience as well, whether or not Japan will allow the United States to launch a strike vis-a-vis China from the Japanese bases. We assume if China tried to invade Taiwan, they have to strike the U.S. bases in Japan to prevent the U.S. intervention. And if China strikes the U.S. bases in Japan, it will constitute the attack on Japan. So we have no choice but to involve in this conflict. So I don't think we will just watch how the things will go on the Taiwan Strait, and we will take sides.
Thank you all, and thank all the panelists and the discussants. I'll now turn the microphone over to Glenn Tiffert, who, as you all know, is the manager of this exceptional program. Glenn?
As the manager of this program, I'd like to thank you all for joining us today for what was truly an excellent program. We hope that you'll be able to attend the remaining sessions in this conference, which will meet every Monday and Thursday, or if you're in Asia and Oceania, that's Tuesday and Friday at the same time for the next 3 weeks. Our next session, entitled Sharp Power, Natural Resources and Sustainable Development, we'll examine the intensifying competition over natural resources in the Indo-Pacific region, particularly its political and geostrategic dimensions. I hope to see you in 3 days. Thank you very much.